From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, filling in for Terry Gross. In 1936, Margaret Lambert was a rising track star and high jumper in Nazi Germany. She was also Jewish. Though trained to be on Germany's Olympic team, a propaganda effort by the German government to dispel criticism of anti-Semitism, she was never allowed to compete. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Margaret Lambert. Also, virus hunters, Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk of the Centers for Disease Control. Their work takes them to remote places where they've studied and collected samples of emerging deadly viruses like Ebola, HIV, and Lassa fever. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new release by Sid Straw of the Golden Palominos. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Last night's events at the Republican National Convention featured Bob Dole's economic plan, but the proposal was described by women. In an attempt to address the gender gap, the keynote speech was delivered by pro-choice Congresswoman Susan Molinari. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republicans moved through another evening of film clips, real people testimonials, and speeches about the American dream. The focus of the night, however, was on attracting women voters to the Dole Kemp ticket. Prominent female Republicans made the case that it is working women who will benefit from Dole's tax cut plan. New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who reduced taxes in her state, said she was proof positive it can be done. Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison challenged President Clinton's commitment to a balanced budget, the Democrats' best argument against Dole's proposal. And Congresswoman Susan Molinari of New York, a new mother, spoke of her own daughter as her father watched from the audience. "I want my daughter to have a future that still loves heroes," she said of Dole, "where character still matters." I'm Elizabeth Arnold in San Diego.
The Teamsters Union has seized control of a Philadelphia local accused of having ties to the mafia and misusing union funds. Teamsters President Ron Carey says the takeover is part of an attempt to purge the nation's largest labor union of corruption. It's the 65th local seized by the national union since Ron Carey won election in 1991. A federal judge in Salt Lake City has ruled the nation's first chemical weapons incinerator can start up soon. U.S. District Judge Tina Campbell denied a request by critics to prevent the plant from opening. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The ruling came after 2 weeks of testimony in which opponents of the Utah chemical weapons incinerator said state and Army officials misled the public. The plant, the opponents said, is unsafe and will expose thousands of people downwind to deadly toxins. But Judge Tina Campbell accepted the Army's claim that more than 1 million aging and deteriorating chemical rockets, bombs, and storage tanks present a greater threat if left in storage. The Army wants to burn 27 million pounds of chemical agent over 7 years at its incinerator 60 miles southwest of Salt Lake City. The Army also wants to build 4 similar plants to destroy chemical weapons stockpiled elsewhere. Test burns in Utah of live chemical agent were delayed by the lawsuit. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
General Mills says it's buying Ralcor cereal and snack mix businesses. The number 2 cereal maker says it will pay $570 million for Ralcor products, which include Chex and Cookie Crisp brands. Ralcor cereals make up about 3% of the U.S. cereal market. On Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 12 points at 5,659. Trading is light. This is NPR. A Saudi Arabian opposition group is reporting 6 men have been arrested in connection with the bombing of a U.S. military barracks last June. The Movement for Islamic Reform in Arabia is based in London. It says 6 Muslim militants have confessed to the Dahran attack that killed 19 U.S. airmen. Neither the Saudi government nor the United States have announced any arrests in connection with the attack. The Clinton administration has said an unknown number of people have been detained for questioning about the attack. One person died and several others were wounded today during a funeral for a Greek Cypriot beaten to death during a rally on Sunday. The rally was in protest of the continuing occupation of the island's northern sector by Turkey. The BBC's Chris Drake reports from Nicosia.
One of the Greek Cypriots managed to get past the human chain formed by the UN peacekeeping force and reach the Turkish side. He ran towards a Turkish flagpole and began trying to climb it. A burst of gunfire rang out and he fell to the ground, apparently dead. There was panic as most of the demonstrators raced back towards their own lines. The UN troops dropped to the ground to take cover, and then a local television station covering the incident live showed one of them, obviously British, shouting to his colleagues to call an ambulance. But even then, many of the demonstrators refused to give up. One brandishing a heavy club could be clearly seen threatening some of the unarmed UN soldiers who were risking their own lives by standing up and trying to persuade the remaining Greek Cypriots to leave the area.
Chris Drank reporting. Peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians are underway for the first time in 6 months. Negotiators belong to the committee dealing with implementing non-security elements of the Palestinian autonomy agreements. One Palestinian negotiator says it's a positive sign that today's meeting is taking place. Palestinians fear Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will tighten Israel's grip on occupied lands by expanding Jewish settlements. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. Our memories of the 1996 Atlanta Olympics are beginning to fade as other spectacles compete for the public's attention. But the memory of the 1936 Berlin Olympics, known as the Nazi Olympics, are still vivid in the minds of those who lived through that period. Hitler used the 36 Games as a powerful propaganda tool to put a positive face on his Nazi government. Fearing an international boycott because of Germany's repressive laws and aggression towards its neighbors, Hitler promised to include Jewish and non-Aryan athletes on his German team. Berlin became a phony showcase of German tolerance with the removal of anti-Semitic graffiti and the display of posters and murals promoting Germany's commitment to peace. Earlier this summer, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum presented an exhibit about the Berlin Olympics. My guest, Margaret Lambert, was a promising Jewish high jumper in Germany in the 1930s, and her story, along with the stories of other Jewish athletes, was featured in the exhibit. Until Hitler's repressive policies and exclusionary laws prevented her from training and competing, Lambert was an Olympic hopeful. But she left Germany and went to England to pursue sports and learn English. As the Hitler government was gearing up for the 36 Games, Lambert was called back to Germany to try out for the Olympics. I asked her if she was invited. She told me she was blackmailed.
The day I won the British Championship on June 30th, 1934, my father had come over, and I thought to watch me compete. And after all, the whole hullabaloo was over, and we got back to the hotel. He told me that he had been approached, that the German government wanted me, or the German Track and Field Association, or whoever they were, wanted me to come back to be a member of the Olympic team. And I couldn't believe it. I said, they threw me out a year ago and now they want me back. I don't think I'm going back. And my father told me that hints were dropped that if I didn't come back, there were repercussions against my family. And since the Nazis were not known to make idle threats, I packed my bags and went home. And my father could not write this to me or phone me this, because if he had told me in writing about the threats, most likely the censor would have caught on to it and my father would have been in trouble.
So by having you, a Jewish athlete, at least try out for the German Olympics, how do you think the Nazi government then was using you for propaganda?
They needed a token Jew and I was it. There were very few Jewish athletes, I mean, especially Jewish girls who were of world-class potential. And I was the only full-blooded Jew, as far as I know, on that Olympic team. There were two half-Jews, and I always say, I guess two half-Jews were only half as offensive to the Nazis than a full-blooded Jew. So, but I was the only Jewish, completely Jewish person on the Olympic team. And the reason I was on was because there was a genuine threat that the Americans and the French and the English and all the bigger nations wanted to boycott the Olympics because on account of the discrimination against the Jewish people. And only after Hitler and the Germans gave their written agreement that there would be no discrimination, they decided, yes, we are coming.
I would think, though, for you as a Jewish athlete and some of the other athletes who were part Jewish in Germany, that there was a real dilemma. Because on the one hand, if you're a serious athlete, you want to compete in the Olympics. And yet, as a German athlete, you would be representing your country, Germany, and its anti-Semitic policies. How did you wrestle with that?
I wrestled for that day and night for 2 years, and I was in a psychological mess, really. It was always on my mind. What am I going to do? Most likely they wouldn't let me compete, I thought, because, as you said, it was almost inconceivable that a German Jew, considering the anti-Semitic propaganda that was going on in Germany, to be a member of the Olympic team and actually competing for Germany. And how would that look for Adolf Hitler? It would look really ridiculous. And I always thought I would not be able to compete, and I wanted to compete in the worst way, just to show what a Jew could do.
Well, I would think that if you won, you certainly could show what a Jew could do, but that might be a dangerous thing to do. And then if you lost, you might feed into the anti-Semitic propaganda, which was part of Hitler's ideology.
You are so right. I have said this so many times. If I would have been a loser either way, whether I won or whether I lost. If I had won, maybe I wouldn't be here today. And had I lost, I would have been, the subject of ridicule and the propaganda that Hitler spread all over Germany.
And did you think about that moment that if you did win and were on the team, whether standing up there and receiving your medal, you might be called on or even forced to give some kind of Nazi salute?
Oh, my God. On my mind for 2 years. Believe me, every day, every night, that was my nightmare. And that was another reason why I believed I would not be called upon to compete, because it was just an impossibility.
Well, as it turned out, you were not chosen to be on the German team. How were you notified?
Well, it was very simple, even though before I was afraid maybe they'll break my legs or something to get rid of me. But the Americans left by ship to sail towards Germany on the 15th of July. And on this, a letter dated on the 16th of July reached me a few days later, saying that most likely I hadn't figured with being on the Olympic team anyway, because I wasn't good enough or I had been too inconsistent or anything like that, even though 2 weeks before that I had equaled the German record with a height which won the gold medal in 3 weeks later, I believe.
And what was that height?
5'3", which today is ridiculous.
So what did you do during the 36 games in Berlin?
I've said this so many times, I do not remember. I must have some kind of amnesia what I did. I don't know whether I listened to the radio. I don't know whether I read about it. I have no recollection whatsoever what I did. And I can't remember a thing. Somebody told me, a friend of mine said that we used to sneak up my back stairs and listen to the radio and be happy when Jesse Owens won. But number one, I don't have any back stairs. And number two, I don't think I had a radio in my room. So I think it was more in her imagination than really what happened. I just don't remember anything.
When Jesse Owens, the Black American athlete, won 4 golds, what do you think his victory meant for Jews, and what did it mean for you?
Well, also much later, I realized that I was in Washington, and when they opened up the Holocaust Museum, they had a special exhibit for the 1936 Olympics, and I kind of helped a little bit and gave them some material. And I told him that I was glad Jesse Owens was my pinch hitter because I couldn't do it myself. So he really embarrassed Adolf Hitler a great deal. And every time I think about it, it makes me feel really very, very good inside.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And Margaret Lambert is my guest. She was a track star in Germany in the 1930s and was invited to train for the 36 Olympics in Berlin, but was not allowed to be on the German team because she was Jewish. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Margaret Lambert, a track star in Germany in the 1930s, and she joins us to talk about her experiences training for the 1936 Olympics. She was not allowed to participate on the German team because she was Jewish. When did you get out of Germany?
Just as soon as the Olympics were over, I went to a resort to think. I said, I have to get away from everybody. I can't stand people telling me maybe it was for the best, and my parents were looking at me with those pitying eyes. I said, I'll go away, and I went to a spa under an assumed name, of course, because you could not be in any hotel as a Jew. So, and I didn't talk to anybody for 2 weeks. I just sat there, and I thought, and I said, I have to get out of here. Immediately. So a friend of my father's who emigrated to the United States when he was a young man became a millionaire here. And when I was still the big shot Olympic candidate, he came visiting once in that small town. And he said to me, well, anytime you want to come to the United States, I will sponsor you. So I wrote him a letter telling him that I would be happy to accept his offer now. And post haste came a letter back telling me that things were very bad in the United States, that maybe I couldn't find a job, maybe things would get better in Germany, and maybe I should rethink my position. So my father got very angry and wrote him a letter back, and that kind of woke him up, I guess, and he did send me the papers. I think I saw the man twice in the United States, and he didn't make any use of his sponsorship, but he did get me into the United States in May of 1937.
How about the rest of your family?
Well, my brother had come here already. He had been sponsored by a fabulous man by the name of Carl Laemmle, who was the father of the motion picture industry, really, who also came from that little hick town that I come from. And he sponsored about 300 Jewish people, and among them my brother. And he had come a few months before me, as poor as a church mouse like I was too, and all our relatives, nobody had any money, but my brother was here. And my family, I had to leave back my 13-year-old brother, my mother, my father. And when I saw them at the railroad station standing there, I swore I would never set foot on German soil again, and I didn't.
And did your parents and other brother get out?
Yes, they got out. They somehow fled to England without anything. They just packed a little bag with some underwear and left the house, left the factory, left everything that they owned back, and were able to get out to England.
Where did
And then finally here, they came here.
And where did you settle once you got to the States?
New York City, where all the refugees congregated.
Well, I was wondering if there was a community of German Jewish refugees in New York.
Oh, yes, there were a lot of them, and they were all around 86th Street, 96th Street, Broadway, you know, on the West Side, and we all helped each other out as much as we could.
How were you able to do that?
Well, for instance, when I wanted to bring my husband over here, I mean my then fiancé, bring him over here, his very rich relatives also refused to give him the papers, even though I swore to them that he would never be a liability to them. And so there was a bank in downtown New York, and I think they tried to help the Jewish people. They never put a date down when the deposit was made. So I borrowed money from $10 here and $50 there. Whoever had money, I borrowed $2,000, deposited in that bank, and then wrote to the consulate in Stuttgart trying to get a visa for him. And it worked.
Hmm. When you were then settled in New York and your fiancé came over, and I guess you finally got married, what kind of work did you do?
Well, I did everything that would make me some money, except a few things that I don't like to mention. I've worked as a housemaid, cleaning up other people's houses. I've worked as a masseuse in a reducing salon, trying to slim down some of my patients there. Mm-hmm. The only one that lost weight was I, because it was very hard work. Mm-hmm. I did anything, babysitting, whatever money I could get, because we were only allowed to bring out $4 when we came, to come out of Germany.
You came to this country with $4?
Yes, and a very nice camera, which everybody bought because we knew that was very sought after in the United States, and we sold it, and that's what we lived on until we could find the work.
How long, then, did you compete as an athlete?
Well, I competed again in the championships and some metropolitan things. In 1938, won another championship, American championship in high jump in 1938. And in 39, I was just getting ready to pack my bag in the morning. I had the radio going. It was September 3rd. And I heard that war had broken out in Europe, and I thought that my priorities were no longer high jumping, and I called my coach and said, I'm not coming, and that was the end of it.
So what did you do instead?
Well, still was trying to make a living, still, trying to get our parents out, trying to get my husband's parents out. My husband, in the meantime, had come over. We had gotten married in September, I think, and before that, some friend of his who came from where he lived had offered him a job. He said, what are you doing? He said, nothing. I have to learn English so I can pass my state boards here. He said, well, if you want to be a house painter, I can give you a job for $18 a week to wash the walls down, or for $24 to paint in the Hotel Biltmore. So my husband said he doesn't know either one, so he's going to take the job that pays him more. And he became a painter in the Hotel Biltmore. And unfortunately, all the other painters were German Nazis and didn't speak a word of English, so he didn't learn any English there, and he quit pretty fast after that because he was afraid of them.
German Nazis in New York?
Oh, yes. Bund members, a lot of them. At that time, they called them Bund. I don't know what kind of an organization, but it was a Nazi organization. And they belonged to it, and he was painting up on a scaffold, up on the top of the ceiling there, and he was afraid they'd do something to him.
Mm. Margaret Lambert is our guest, and she was a track star in Germany in the 1930s, was a world-class high jumper, and was invited to train for the 36 Olympics in Berlin, but not allowed to be a part of the German team because she was Jewish. And we're talking about her experiences both in Germany, but also in the States as well. Well, let's get up to the present tense. And you had vowed never to return to Germany. But I'm curious why you went to the Atlanta Olympics in this summer in 1996 at the invitation of the German Olympic Committee. Did that create any dilemmas for you?
Well, in a way, yes. And in a way, no. I finally came to the realization that the younger generation in Germany had nothing to do with what happened to us, and you can't hold them responsible for it. And I felt it was time for some kind of a closure, and I had been in touch with these people before. They had tried to approach me before, invited me to come to Germany, and I said no. And they really tried very hard to make amends. And when this came, I said, I think this is a nice gesture, and I think I will accept it. It took me about 5 seconds to decide. I said to my husband, we're going. Huh. And that was it.
Did being at the Olympics and being there as a guest of the German Olympic Committee bring some kind of closure to this chapter of your life, this time in 1936 when you were not allowed to be on the team, but also when Jewish athletes and Jews in Germany were at such severe risk?
Well, I don't know if it's a closure completely. I don't think I will ever get over the fact that I was cheated out of being an Olympic competitor, because that is something that is so special. I mean, so few are, you know, so many try to make it, and so few do make it. And I don't think I'll ever get over it, that I was not allowed to do it. But I think otherwise my head kind of healed a little bit, because I sat there like a spectator, not like a victim, I think. You know, I went to the opening ceremonies, and I had no peculiar feeling. I just sat there and enjoyed myself. And the few times when I saw we were sitting right opposite where they awarded the medals to the winners and the second and third, and a few times it was like a stab in the heart. And one time, a couple of tears came rolling down. But all in all, I think I behaved quite well.
Well, what was it like to watch some of the female athletes? And I'm particularly interested in some of the female high jumpers. I don't know what the world record is now, but I assume it's probably a little bit more.
It's close to 7 feet, I think, as far as the women are concerned. And the technique is completely different, and I don't understand how they do it. So, I mean, for me, I was just trying to watch how in the world do they do that flop that they're doing. And I still haven't figured it out, and I don't think I'll ever try it.
Do you think the German Olympic Committee wanted you to forgive them?
Oh, yes. I mean, I can't forgive them because they had nothing to do with it. I don't forgive them who did this. And I always say, what happened to me is such a small thing when you think about all the other consequences. My husband lost his parents and about 30 relatives in the concentration camps. So what is not being allowed to compete in the Olympics compared to that? But to me, of course, it's still quite important. But I can't forgive those who did all that stuff. But I can't hold the ones that I met now responsible for it.
Well, Margaret Lambert, it's been a real pleasure to have you with us today on Fresh Air, and I thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you. The pleasure was all mine.
Margaret Lambert was a high-class or world-class high jumper in the 1930s. She was prevented from competing on the German team for the 1936 Berlin Olympics because she was Jewish. Her story, along with the story of the other Jewish athletes, was featured in an exhibit on the 36 Games at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum earlier this summer. I'm Artie Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the role of urbanization in the spread of deadly viruses. We talk with Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk about their work hunting and bringing back deadly viruses to the Center for Disease Control's Hot Zone Lab. They have a new book. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews War and Peace, the new release by Sid Straw. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. For 25 years, doctors Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk have been tracking and studying the most deadly of viruses, Ebola, Lassa fever, Hanta, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, and AIDS. Their work has taken them to villages in Zaire in the Sudan, to crowded cities and rainforests in Brazil, to nomadic settlements in Pakistan, to the high-tech hot zone or level 4 lab of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Their groundbreaking work has done much to add to the understanding of these dangerous viruses, which have confounded scientists and pose a real threat to humans. McCormick and Fisher-Hawk tell their story in the new book, Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC, written with Leslie Allen Harvitz. They married a few years ago and are currently teaching at Aga Khan University Medical School in Pakistan. They said that to trace the path of these deadly viruses, you have to begin in Africa.
Ebola virus and Lassa virus appear to be members of families of viruses that are quite old. You find members of both families of these viruses on different continents. However, you find multiple members in Africa, and one would have to guess, given the fact that Africa seems to be somewhat the cradle of biology, that it's likely that these viruses originated there, but they went to other continents a very long time ago. So these viruses have been around undoubtedly before human beings were around and have co-evolved with the various species of animals and insects that act as their reservoirs.
Well, Susan, let me ask you about Ebola and Lassa, because I'm curious about how that got transmitted from animals to humans, whether it had to do with a bite or airborne transmission or eating the animals. Do you know how that happened, how that occurred?
We are pretty sure that what you have to do to infect yourself with either these viruses is to inoculate them either under your skin or rub them into an open cut or abrasion or rub them into your eyes, the mucosa of the eyes, or maybe inside the mouth. We're pretty sure that if you do that with these viruses, you will infect themselves. So imagine a situation where you have somebody, a poor person working either in the forest or a woman in the house with cuts on her hands, and there are rodents running around, and sometimes, for instance, in the villages, they have no electricity. So when they finish their evening meal, they will put the remains of the food under the bed, and the rodents will have a feast all night, and in the morning, the woman washes up. And at that time, she may very well get urine on her hands and infect herself. With Ebola, we just don't know, because we don't know what the source is. If we knew what the source is, then I could give you some hypothetical situations. With Crimean Congo, which is just as nasty a disease and more widespread, it's a little bit easier to describe what happens, because it's a tick bite. And the tick itself is infected on an animal which has the virus in its blood and ingests the blood with the virus, just rather like malaria and mosquitoes. This tick will then bite a human and transmit the virus. So that's a little bit simpler.
Do you feel like you're at war with these viruses?
I think that in a sense we all are. We're constantly at war with the organisms that surround us, that can infect us, and particularly for those organisms that can be transmitted from one person to another. When we see what's happened in the last four or five decades, we see more people who are going out into the forests, rainforests, but not only in South America, but in Africa and Asia, and coming in contact more and more. More frequently with the ecological the ecological environment that these forests have, and they're encountering these new viruses. In addition to that, we have large numbers of people who live very close together in cities, and they're able to transmit the virus one person to another in many instances. And so we as human beings are going to have to become more and more aware of this, and I believe we're going to have better surveillance and a better system for being able to respond to these situations when we see them.
Susan, much of your work, both of your works really have been in countries in Africa, and I know that you're doing work in Pakistan now. Do you think people living in the so-called developed world, in countries like the United States, should be concerned about Ebola viruses in Zaire and fear some kind of contagion because of that?
I think they should be concerned. I think that to have a high level of fear is probably unnecessary and unwarranted. Some of these viruses have relatively long incubation periods, so it's quite possible for somebody in a remote area to get infected, to get on a bus, get to the city, buy an airplane ticket and arrive in the United States. And we describe an episode like that in the book, which really did happen. A man came back to Chicago from Nigeria with Lassa fever, and he died of it in Chicago. So that can certainly happen. However, I think that provided we are well-educated ourselves in the United States, our physicians understand what these diseases look like, ask the right kinds of questions of the patients, we ought to be able to identify and handle the patients both safely and well, and hopefully let them also survive. I think, though, in the general sense, that we should be concerned about all the possibilities of viruses emerging from poor countries, not just viruses, but also bacteria and bacteria that are resistant to antimicrobials, because there are a lot of people out there and a lot of people are also infected. And this allows organisms to change, to become more pathogenic, to evade antimicrobials and to spread. And unless we pay attention to the conditions of people in poor countries, we're not going to be able to stop this happening.
I'm curious, with these very severe viruses, the Lassa viruses and the Ebola viruses, because they are self-limiting, is it possible, do you think, to have an enormous plague? Joseph?
I think that that given today's circumstances, I don't think it's likely. I think it's very unlikely to have this kind of plague. I think what is far more likely is the kind of plague we see with HIV. But since the diseases with Ebola and Lassa and Crimean Congo that we've talked about, even Hantaan virus, which we know now in the United States, these are such dramatic diseases, and we understand them sufficiently well that when we see a cluster of cases, we know how to deal with them. We know how to stop the transmission. Where we would fail is if we had another virus like HIV, where we didn't see anything for a very long period of time while it was being transmitted silently from one person to another. We have such a virus that occurs here in the United States that would appear to be occurring at fairly high levels of transmission, for example, in Asia, and that's hepatitis C. It's a silent disease. It has a long incubation period like HIV and causes end-stage liver disease. And we're seeing very high levels of transmission in at least in Pakistan.
Joseph, I know that you were instrumental in isolating the oldest HIV strain. Is it still important to know where HIV came from?
Well, I think I think it's important to understand how this all happened. I don't think it's important in trying to blame anyone or point any fingers at anybody. I don't think that's a useful exercise. But I think it's important to have some perspective about how this happened. In this particular instance, what we wanted to know is, could we find any evidence that would support our hypothesis that HIV could circulate at very low levels in rural populations without the kind of epidemic disease that we're seeing in the cities. And so we were fortunate enough to have a collection of serum that was that we obtained during the outbreak of Ebola in very remote area of northern Zaire in 1976. We went back to look at those and found that we had less than 1% of the people that we took blood samples in 1976 had in fact antibodies to HIV, and from one of those we actually isolated the virus, and that still remains, to my knowledge, the oldest virus that we have. More importantly, we were able to go back to that same exact area and resample those villages 10 years later. And when we did that, we found, lo and behold, that the level of HIV was completely unchanged. It was exactly the same as it was 10 years before. Now, this is one of those areas that is remote, and this is partly the basis. We have some other evidence from a remote area of Sudan that's very similar. And this is part of the evidence that I think is supportive of the fact that the virus was able to persist, but at very low levels. And given its long incubation period, it didn't need to have high rates of transmission. And it was only when people began to move and change their behavior that we started to see the kind of problem we see today.
Well, I'm talking today with virologist Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk, and they have collaborated on a book called Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC. CDC standing for Centers for Disease Control. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Drs. Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk, and their book is called Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC. How do you work in the field? And we've been talking about AIDS and Lassa and Ebola and some of the other more dangerous viruses. When you're working in a place like Africa or perhaps in Pakistan or other countries around the world where you have set up labs, what do you bring with you, and where do you begin your investigation? Joseph, let me put that to you.
Okay. Well, if you're going into a fairly remote area, which we often do, we try to take those things which are absolutely essential. It's a little bit like backpacking. You take those, you try to know what you need and take only that which you need, because usually your means of conveyance are limited, and you don't want to be overburdened.
So what we take are
the materials to make a diagnosis, if possible, in the field. Now that has often meant in the past taking a what's called a fluorescent microscope, which is kind of a special form of a microscope, and some reagents, slides, some solutions in bottles, pipettes, and other things that you need to set up and run your laboratory. Obviously, all this depends on having some kind of source of electricity. Now, if you're going to an area that has no electricity, then you're even going to be more limited in what you will do. And in those situations, often you will try to do the public health that's needed, but try to leave the diagnostic part and the other scientific part to later. And so you collect specimens and store them, and almost always, no matter where we go, we would take a tank, a specially made tank that's like a vacuum flask, and we put liquid nitrogen inside of it. That liquid nitrogen will keep viruses cold and preserved for many, many days. And this allows us to go into even the most remote areas, collect material, blood specimens or other tissues or even environmental specimens where we might want to try to isolate virus, keep them preserved, and take them back to a laboratory, a level 4 laboratory very often, where we can work with them more efficiently and certainly more safely.
What do you do to protect yourself?
Well, when you're in the field, you obviously want to carry things like gloves, and we usually carry these paper or plasticized gowns. We carry masks. Some people use the respirator masks. Other people will use just the plain sort of surgical masks. One of the things we always do is to examine patients, to take care of them. We collect specimens. We don't back away from doing that.
Well, I know in the Sudan in 1979, you got poked with a needle after inserting it into a woman you suspected had the Ebola virus.
I was lucky on that one. Indeed, when I stuck myself, I was kneeling down in a dark hut with my colleague Roy Barron holding a kerosene lantern over me, and I was trying to take a blood specimen from this elderly lady who was who had a very high fever and was delirious. And indeed, I stuck myself. which made me very angry at myself more than anything else. But it also certainly was frightening, and I had to make a decision. Was I going to leave, or was I going to wait and see what happened? I made the decision that if I left, that the investigation would have to come to a halt, and I wasn't sure she had Ebola, although she was mixed in with a group of patients, most of whom did have Ebola. But I was lucky. She did not develop antibody to Ebola, and she recovered, which said to me that she didn't have Ebola.
I'm curious, once you have gathered some of these viruses in the field, and I assume that the next step is to transport them to some kind of laboratory, a level 4 lab, what do you do to make sure that these deadly viruses are going to be safe in transport?
You enclose them in a vial that you can seal, which you then put in another vial that you can seal, and you pack them in. This is plastic, not glass. You must not use glass. And pad them very carefully and just make sure that everything is double leak-proofed at least. And usually we go triple leak-proofed. Next thing you have to do is make sure that they're preserved correctly, which is why we drop them into liquid nitrogen. And those tanks are also very solid. So when they're in transport, certainly from the field to the level 4 lab in the U.S., they're in a pretty impregnable wrapping. We don't have very many concerns at that point.
Susan, I'd like to have you describe for us what a level 4 lab looks like. And of course, we're talking about a lab at the CDC.
You work within a spacesuit, which for reasons which are unclear to me is a sort of baby blue.
And it has, what do you want, pink?
Well, I don't know. I guess baby blue is better than pink. And you have a big plastic visor over your face so that you've really got pretty good all-round vision. The suit has pipes in it which air condition your head and your arms and your legs and even your back. You have to understand your own personal suit pretty well to keep it in good working order. You put it on and you hook yourself up to some air, and then you have to go through a series of self-locking sealing doors through an airlock into the lab itself. And then you go from airline to airline, usually seeing how far you can get without changing, because we all get a little bit lazy, particularly as we get more experienced. But inside there, you can do most anything in some comfort and considerable level of safety. I've never, working in that lab at CDC, I've never had any serious worries.
Well, since you're working with these very deadly viruses, are you the kind of person who gets imaginary symptoms or phantom symptoms? Thinking,
nope.
Nope? You said that without a pause.
No question about
no
that.
Question.
That's really funny, because I've had, in the days that I was running the Lassa Fever Project out in Sierra Leone, I had many young folks who came through the system for working out there for shorter periods of time. And inevitably, they would come in and say, I think I have a sore throat. Boy,
sure.
My throat is really sore. Do you think I could have lots of fever? So this is a common occurrence.
Well, Susan, you said nope very quickly. How about you, Joseph?
No, I'm not. In fact, the 3 or 4 days, I have to tell you, after I stuck my finger, those were the days if I were going to have imaginary symptoms, I would definitely have started having imaginary symptoms. And I'm sure I had some, but I was able to rationalize myself into knowing that, in fact, I was not becoming ill.
Both of you have been working for some time now trying to understand and corral, I guess, some of these more deadly viruses. Where are you in that hunt, in that discovery, and what questions are you looking to answer? And Joseph, let me get an answer from you.
Well, I think that we still have a ways to go. In fact, quite a long ways to go. The encouraging things that have happened is it would appear that at least some of these diseases are amenable to treatment with a particular antiviral drug called ribavirin. It looks like probably Hantan is somewhat amenable to this drug, certainly Lassa virus, and more recently been working with Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever. And certainly the initial studies, but we're a long way from completing those, are encouraging. So that's a positive note. On the other side, we still are a long way from understanding where Ebola lives in in its natural environment and what it is that spreads it to humans. But perhaps more importantly, we are a long way from being able to control the diseases that are more prevalent. And by the way, Ebola is probably the least prevalent of most of these diseases. The most prevalent ones are Lassa and Hantaan virus, Hantaan infection, which occurs throughout the world. And we are a long way from knowing how to control those. These are rodent-borne diseases. And quite frankly, we go back to the issues we were talking about earlier, and that is the social and economic conditions, because much of the transmission occurs among poor people who live in rural areas who simply don't have adequate housing and are uneducated about how to prevent contact with these rodents. And that really is the, as far as I'm concerned, the crux of the public health issue. So on the treatment side, we've made some progress. We've not made a lot of progress on the vaccine side, I think in large part because there hasn't been much funding for this. I mean, the number of people who work on these viruses, with the exception of HIV, is pretty minuscule. And with this number of people and the few facilities that are available, it's hard to make progress very rapidly. And I think I do think this is an area where some more resources would be very helpful. And I think these resources I'd like to see them spread out both in the United States and in other parts of the world, because I think we need more facilities in many different areas.
Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk have collaborated on a new book, Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC. This is Fresh Air. Although the new album, War and Peace, is only Sid Straw's second release, she's established a high profile as a singer for the New York cult band The Golden Palominos. And she's led an eclectic career singing backup for everyone from Pat Benatar to the Lemonheads. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews War and Peace, which he thinks contains at least one song that's a small masterpiece.
Sid Straw has a very sincere voice, one that is at once breathy and strong. On War and Peace, she's found some fine support for her vocals in The Skeletons, a Missouri band whom some of you may remember when they were called the Morels. Until now, Straw's performances of other people's songs have been very uneven, many of them hammering rock that left her yelling a lot. But Straw has written every song on War and Peace, and the result is both more authoritative and more serenely considered. And at least one song here, called CBGB's, is flat out great.
Hey, remember me? We met 10 years ago at CBGB's on New Year's Eve. Back when you were attending bar, you had a band of your own called the Revlons. And I liked your songs.
At one point, Straw says, "I was married for a while. It ended in tragedy. Oh well, enough about me." And then she goes back to asking this guy whether any of the dreams he told her about 10 years ago in that bar ever came true. Her heartbreakingly casual, sincere modesty, in the way she only permits herself to think about herself for three brief lines, just gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. The fact that such fragile feelings are carried along on a cushion of crashing guitars and drums only adds to this song's emotional power. On another song on this album, Sid Straw sings, "You can't blame a girl for crying." But the sadness in CBGB's isn't anything like pity or empty melancholy. This is one of the few rock songs that takes the full measure of the passing of time, the way our dreams become diminished and painful, yet somehow pleasurable in the remembering. Sid Straw isn't afraid to cry, and she knows how to make real music out of it.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Today, we reluctantly say goodbye to our intern, Phoebe Van Scoy, who, despite the unceasing demands upon her, has been able to stay cool and enthusiastic with energy to spare. We've been impressed by her hard work and her raucous personality. We wish her all the best, and we wish ourselves more interns like her. Good luck, Phoebe. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.